is for those who can't recognize on their own the beauty of Torah. So it needs to be packaged so beautifully to show the excitement, the enthusiasm that one could have through being associated with Torah, through learning Torah. Nowadays it's been decreed by the Chacham and we don't translate the Torah anymore into Yavanis. But we have other ways to show how exciting the Torah could be. And that's the people who embody the Torah, the people who study the Torah all day, show and give over how exciting the Torah is, how exciting it could be, how enthusiastic one could be with learning Torah, with getting new insights, to understanding Hashem, to understanding His creation, to understanding us and other people, to understanding how we should live our lives properly. Certainly this is the antithesis of what Yavin wanted to do. Certainly this is part of the nace of winning the Melchama. Hashem has continued the nace along through Galus. Hanukkah was the last miracle. And it will carry us until the coming of Mashiach. And therefore we see Hashem creating this miracle over and over. And there are little candles, little sparks that have come up in various communities. Not every community merits a kollel. Not every community merits a kollel such as the Philadelphia community kollel. Not every community merits those who are friends and supporters as the Philadelphia community kollel. And therefore in selecting new young light it was a tough challenge. Number one, the misses had to they had to send in recipes. They had to send in samples. Somehow it just works out that Baruch Hashem, fellows who know how to learn well, somehow their wives know how to, I think that's the fuel, that's what it is. Their wives know how to cook well and bake well. And we appreciate once again the display, the decor, and the delectables that we are enjoying. And each of them, Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Yaakov, and Rabbi Yochanan, really truly personable, Talmidei Chachamim, Balei Midos, and so far they've made a tremendous impression on the community. Kodesh Baruch Hu should give us the strength to continue this great miracle, to continue to spread the light, which is small. It's small in a big sea of the communities, the influences in the world around us, but yet that small light seems to penetrate one by one and it's spreading and it's growing further and further. Baruch Hashem, the influence of the Kollel and the impact is having great success. Without further ado, we'd like to introduce tonight's guest speaker, Rabbi Yosef Yaakov Reinman. Yaakov Yosef Reinman. Rabbi Reinman is indeed a unique individual. He is a Mechaber Sfarim. Actually, Kang, one of the reasons I invited him is because I wanted his new Sefer, which he indeed brought. He just put out a new Sefer on Chumash and the Yom Tovim. He has written other Sfarim earlier in his lifetime. He's also written many different books under pseudonyms. And more recently, and in my opinion, this is really his claim to fame, he has published and written two books of Rav Matisyahu Solomon's talks and lectures and speeches and vadim. And many people here have learned them and do learn them, you should know, on a regular basis. We have some chavrusas who come here weekly and learn the svarim. The one on chinuch, the one on emuna, they're learned, they're devoured. And this wisdom that Rabbi Matisyahu was able to give over, Rabbi Reinman has been able to capture in book form. It's another book that he wrote also, I think, for our crowd. We could leave that on the side. If the other book, if you go online under books that were, there's another book that Rabbi Reimer wrote just to appreciate his broadness. He has had an email correspondence with a Reform rabbi. It's safe to say that the Reform rabbi does not look like Rabbi Reimer does today. But it's also safe to say that Rabbi Reimer still looks like Rabbi Reimer, even when he engaged in this dialogue, in this correspondence. But it's a fascinating book. The name of the book is One People, Two Worlds. Also a very interesting book for those that like to read this correspondence between the Orthodox rabbi and the Reform rabbi. And we've had, many years ago, Rabbi Reimer did come and grace us with his words on Chanukah, and we've asked him to come back and share some Divrei Torah for Chanukah.
First of all, I want to apologize for being a little bit late, because I thought to myself, when will I prepare what to say? I'll prepare while I'm driving. So while I was driving, I started thinking what to say. The next thing I knew, I'd gone 15 miles north on the turnpike, and I had to turn around and come back. And so I really apologize. As Rabbi Bieberfeld said, you know, basically what I do is I write. I do speak from time to time, but I wouldn't call myself a speaker. I just, you know, I write. So there's a certain, but I do speak sometimes. And there's a problem that speakers have, which I don't really figure out how to deal with it. I have a sister of mine lives in Flatbush, and she invites me to come every year, Rosh Hashanah. So I've been there 7 years. So last year, I'm thinking to myself, I'm here 7 years, and I don't want to say the same thing again, and I don't remember what I said, you know, after 6 years, who knows what I said. So I didn't know what to do, so I called my brother. So he tells me that a speaker once told him the secret to this problem. He said that a Dvar Torah, you could say over in a week. Nobody will remember. Say it over in a week. A story, you have to wait for a year. A joke, you can never say again. So I said, what do you mean? Last year, after I spoke, two fellows came over and they asked me something about what I said the year before. So he said, they must have thought it was a joke. Anyway, as Rabbi Bieberfeld said, I've been here before. I don't remember what I said. I don't remember if the people here are the same people that were here then, but if these are the same people, and if I do say the same thing that I said then, I assure you, it is not a joke. Okay. Anyway, I want to speak about, not directly about Hanukkah, I want to speak about something that happened about 85 years before Hanukkah. So I'm sure most of you are familiar with Greek history, so if you just be patient, let me just do a little bit of a recap of what happened at that time. About 330 BC, I think it was, Alexander the Great. Now, Alexander was from Macedonia. It was a kingdom that was north of Greece, but basically he was a student of Aristotle, and when he conquered Greece, and then he went out and he conquered the world. And he was basically representing Greek civilization. The Macedonians were students of Aristotle, the culture was Greek, and they were spreading Greek civilization. And when Alexander conquered, basically all of the civilized world at that time, I don't know about China, these places, but he conquered the entire eastern rim of the Mediterranean, he conquered Mesopotamia, he conquered Persia, he penetrated into India, and that was basically the civilized world at that time. On the outside, there were the Parthians that he didn't conquer. Parthia, I think, is probably now in Afghanistan. To the west, there was the stirrings of Rome, but Rome wasn't anything yet. He conquered everything. And then he died. And after he died, his kingdom, his empire, was divided into four kingdoms. One of them was Greece itself. One of them was Egypt, under the reign of the kings who were called Ptolemy. The other one was Syria, the Seleucid Empire. That was, the kings were called either Seleucus or Antiochus. And the fourth was in Turkey, Asia Minor, which was then a collection of small Greek states, and headed by Pergamum, but that was the fourth. These were the four parts of the empire. Ptolemy in Egypt built a library in Alexandria, which was one of the wonders of the ancient world. He collected every book that there was, books that looked like these books. There were scrolls tied with strings, but he collected all the books, and he had a library. You can go there, you can get any book, and that was a marvelous thing. Then he decided, and we'll get back to this a little bit later, but then he decided that he needs a translation of the Torah to include in his library, that his library would not be complete without a translation of the Torah. So the Gemara says what happened, that they called 70 Zakenim, came down, and they translated it, and they were all the same. And this was called the Septuagint. This is the Greek Bible, the Greek translation of the Bible. And that was translated, and it was put into the library of Alexandria. Now, the Megillus Tainus, is written by Tanoim, says that there were 3 days in Tevis, Ches, Tes, and Yud Tevis, and one of these 3 days says when they translated the Torah into Greek, 3 days of darkness came down to the world. Now, it doesn't mean that the sun was blotted out. It means it was a terrible, terrible event. It was a tragic event, and it was like 3 days of darkness. So the question is, what was so terrible about translating the Torah into Greek? What was so bad about it? Why was it such a tragic thing? So many Svarim discuss this. They offer all kinds of opinions. Another problem is that it says in the Torah that Moshe Rabbeinu Be'er Heitev, that he took the Torah. The Gemara says in Saita that when they came to Eretz Yisrael, they put up these big stone, these monoliths, and they put cement over them, and they engraved in it the translation of the Torah in 70 languages. And that was important, to translate the Torah, to show people what it was. So why was it all right? Why was it all right for Moshe to translate the Torah at that time, and why was it such a tragedy when the Talmai had the Torah translated for the Library of Alexandria? Now, if you go back to the ancient world was originally pagan. Now, in a pagan world, they all believed in gods. And there's one book that I wrote, by the way, Rabbi Bieberfeld did not mention, which is called Destiny, which is a history book. And over there I really discussed these topics. The human beings living in the world of the gods, the concept of a god to the people in the pagan world, was the god was really like an over, especially in Greek mythology, especially that a god was, I call it the god race. They were like these big super race of basically people. They behaved like people that had the same type of, you know, conflicts with each other, feuds and drives. But they were only very, very powerful and invisible. But people believed that they're living in the world of the gods. And if you live, so what that meant was that the human race was a subservient race. Imagine if there would be another species which is inferior to us and intelligent. Such a species which would have to be subservient to the human race would not be able to aspire to high levels of morality and spirituality because you're living in achna, you're living in subservience to a higher race. And the human race was living in subservience to the God race. And that made the people immoral, it made them brutish, it made them violent, it made them very self-centered. And the whole world, the whole pagan world, that was what it was like. There was no kind of, I mean, the whole idea of chesed didn't exist. It was a very different world. There were two ways that the human race came out of this world. One was the Greek way, and one was the Jewish way. The Greeks, and both of these presented a universal idea for the human race, which elevated the human race. The Greeks decided that instead of worshipping the gods, they decided that the human race is superior to the gods. That even, first of all, whether they believed in the gods or not, I mean, many of them didn't believe in the gods, but even if they believed in them, a god could not write a poem. A god could not write a symphony. These gods were basically lower forms. They said that the human beings being able, because of the genius of the human mind and the human creativity, so the humans were higher than the gods. So the pinnacle of the world was the human being. The human being was the object of worship. This is what we call today secular humanism. That means that the ultimate in the world is the human being, and that is the object of worship. Everybody worships. You worship something. You worship a movie star. You worship an athlete. You worship something. You worship Gandhi. You worship God. You worship, you worship the human being, the idea of the human being. And that was what the Greeks said. The Greeks said that the human beings are superior, and human beings are the object of worship. Is it God? You know, like Plato said, God is the first cause, but God is not involved in the world. This was real kfira. The Greek idea was kfira. God's not involved in the world. God, whatever this God is, first cause, created the world, and that's it. And now in the world, the God of the world is the human being. That was the Greek idea. And this elevated the human race above the gods, whether or not they existed. I mean, in the Greek writers, Aristophanes in his plays makes fun of the gods. I'm not going to go tell you all the scenes that he writes, but human beings were superior. The Jewish idea came with a different way. The Jewish recognized that there is a transcendent God. There's a God who is Ein Sof, the God who is perfect, and a God who is involved and connected with the world and demands something of humanity and communicates with humanity and reveals himself to humanity, and he wants a relationship with humanity and the human race. By connecting with God, by having a relationship, by doing His will as He revealed it to us, that way the human race is exalted and uplifted to the highest levels. These are two different approaches to how the human race becomes uplifted. And each of these is a universal idea. Now, a long time ago, I read a book by a Greek historian called Herodotus. Herodotus considered the first secular historian. He wrote a book called The Persian War. And it's basically he didn't think of himself seriously as a scientist, as a historian. He was a gossip writer. He traveled all around the ancient world, and he wrote about every people that he ever met, and wrote about the people that he didn't meet. He wrote about what he heard about them, all the legends, very entertaining. He's got all kinds of stories, and I wouldn't dare tell over some of these stories to you, but it's exhaustive. But every people in the ancient world, he wrote about them. And a very interesting book. And when I finished, I realized, where are the Jews? The Jews, he does not mention the Jews. So I went through it again. I didn't read it, but I just riffled through it again. Couldn't find it. In the index, I looked this. I did maybe Israel, maybe Jews, maybe this. Nothing. Nothing. Don't understand. What is it? Why does he mention the Jews? I had no answer to this. Then a little while later, I read Josephus wrote a book called Antiquities. And in Antiquities, he writes about this period of when Talmai had the Torah translated. And he writes that one of his ministers came to the king Talmai, and he said to him, your library will not be complete unless you translate the Torah. You have to translate the Torah. So he said, and if you're going to ask, because this is important, it's a very important book. So if you're going to ask me, how come our writers never write about the Jews? He asked my kasha, how come your writers never write about the Jews? So he says, because we have a tradition that if you write about the Jews, you end up being harmed. So it was some kind of a superstition that they had, that some people might think that the reason why Herodotus didn't write about the Jews is because he didn't like them. But that's not true, because the ones that he didn't like, he wrote about the most. And he wrote as many nasty things as he could possibly write. So that couldn't be why. So he says because they had a superstition that you don't write about the Jews. So they knew that these Jews were not a large group. And they lived around Yerushalayim, they were sober people, and they had some kind of connection to a supernatural world, and that you stayed away from them, you didn't write about them, you didn't talk about them, and if you did, then you were okay. If you started writing, you got into trouble. And this he says from somebody called Hecateus of Abdera, who was an ancient writer. So he says, so that's why, okay, fine. So he said, well, let's translate it. So they went and they translated the Torah. Now, after the Greeks conquered the world, the first thing you do after you conquer, what do? You conquer and you look around, okay, you're all set. Now you look around and you say, all right, where's the threat going to come from? And I think you plan for the future. What's going to be? Should we protect ourselves from an invasion from Ethiopia? Should we worry about the Parthians? Should we worry about these Romans who look like maybe they're headed somewhere? What should we do? And there were no real enemy. They looked around, they didn't really see. They thought maybe the Parthians were the biggest threat. But when they translated the Torah, the Greeks saw that this is the enemy. The Torah was the enemy of the Greek culture, of the Greek civilization, and this was the greatest threat to the survival of Greek civilization, was the Torah. And you know something? They were right. The Torah did bring down Greek civilization by itself, and then eventually through Christianity, it buried it for 1,000 years. Greek civilization did not reappear until the time of the Renaissance. The Renaissance was the rebirth of Greek civilization. Even though all their paintings and everything were about Madonna and child, they weren't glorifying that. They were glorifying the painter and the genius of the painters who could make this incredible art. That's what they were doing. It was the rebirth of humanism, the rebirth of the glorification of the human being. That was the Renaissance. And that was in the 1400s, for 1,000 years was buried. This was the enemy. An idea is more dangerous than an army. An idea is more dangerous. An army you could defeat. It's very hard to defeat an idea. The Greeks themselves, when they won, when they conquered, they had a lot to do with the idea that they were representing rather than just the armies that they had. Now, what was the first, as anybody can, you're welcome to, what was the first instance of religious persecution in the history of the world? What was the first instance? So the first instance, I guess no volunteers, the first instance was Hanukkah. Until Hanukkah, there was no such thing as religious persecution. When Nebuchadnezzar said that you have to bow down to my idol, that was not religious persecution. That was political. I'm the king. If you don't bow down to my idol, then you're not honoring me. If this is my God and I'm the king, then you bow down to me, you bow down to my idol. But once you've bowed down to my idol, you can go home and do whatever you want. Keep Shabbos, you can kosher, whatever you want. No problem. The pagan world was very, very tolerant. There was no conflict. There was plenty of room for another god. You have another god? Fine. We have room for him. You want me to bring a sacrifice to him? I'll bring a sacrifice to him. Bow down. You bow down to me. I'll bow down to you. No problem. Everything was fine. There was no problem of conflict among all the gods, and there was no religious persecution. This past Friday, there was an opinion piece in the Times, which I saw, which amazingly many other people saw, by David Brooks. It's about the Hanukkah story. I don't know if anybody here saw it. So in this, I mean, of course, he has a different perspective. He comes from the book that I wrote, One People, Two Worlds, with the Reform Rabbi. So we're good friends still. And he's definitely improved. But he doesn't have a beard and pay, he said, but he has improved. But I asked him one time, I said to him once, do your people know that Hanukkah is the victory of the Orthodox over the Reform? That's what we celebrate. So he says, no, we don't tell them that. But that's really what Hanukkah is, because the Mesyavnim. But anyway, where was I after? Oh, so there was no religious persecution. But this article, right, it's David Brooks. So he writes a piece of information which I didn't know, and it's very interesting to me, that Antiochus, so from his treasury, he supported many, many different religions. But he persecuted the Jewish religion. So he says, the historians are puzzled. I mean, if he's sending money from his treasury to build temples for all these different religions, why is he persecuting the Jewish religion? So he says they must have been rebellious, which is nonsense. That's not why they persecuted them. Because all those religions were not a threat to Greek civilization. They were nothing. The Torah, the religion of the Torah, the idea in the Torah, that was a threat, and that had to be destroyed. And they went out to destroy it. Now, it took time. It took time. First they translated the Torah, probably took a little while till they read it, and they analyzed it, and the scholars studied it, and they figured, okay, how are we going to deal with this? But 85 years is not a long time. Little by little they started to get the people to assimilate, to become Mesyavnim, to Hellenize the Jewish people. They drew them into becoming more Greek. So that was one thing. And then they attacked the Torah, the laws of the Torah. They banned them, little by little. They banned Mila, they banned Shabbos, and they banned Rosh Chodesh. They did not allow the Beis Din to make Kiddush HaChodesh, to establish the months of the calendar. And this is what they did in an attempt to destroy the Torah. Now, what exactly was it in the Torah? What exactly was it in the Torah that they saw that was so terribly threatening to them? They saw the idea of a transcendent God. Okay, fine, so that's the idea of a transcendent God. So we say there's also a God with the first cause, but he's not involved. So there's more in the Torah. The idea, in the Torah you see revelation. You see that God spoke to people, he communicated with people, he told them what he wants from them, he demands standards from them, he demands certain type of behavior from them. That God communicates this. It's not made up of himself. It comes from God. That's what it says in the Torah. So why couldn't they just deny it? Why can't they just say it's a legend, it's a myth, it's nothing? Why can't they just do that? Why did they have to go ahead and persecute it? Why didn't they just make fun of it or say it's nothing? Which brings us to a little bit of a different topic. We'll jump ahead to Pesach. Now, in the Torah, there are punishments for lavim. If a person is over on a lav, if a person is, for a prohibition, then there are punishments. But for mitzvahs haseh, there are no punishments. There's a mitzvah, do this, no punishment, except for two. Mila and Pesach, Karban Pesach. If you don't bring a Karban Pesach, there's karis. A person's life is shortened if he doesn't bring a Karban Pesach. Maybe someone can help me out. Where does it say that this car is by Karban Pesach? Does anybody know? I mean, which parsha is it? You know, anybody want to help me with this? No. What? Valoyscha. Oh, the man knows. Okay. The parsha of Pesach is in Bai. The whole parsha of Karban Pesach is in Parsha's Bai. I figured somebody would fall into the trap. I guess not. So the whole parsha of Pesach is in Parsha's Bai. Doesn't say anything there that if you don't bring a Karban Pesach, there's Karis. But in Bahaloyscha, which is the parasha of Pesach Sheni, that the people came to Moshe Rabbeinu, they said, Loma Nigora, we were Tomei, we couldn't bring a Karban Pesach, why should we be worse? So Moshe Rabbeinu went, and he asked Rabbeinu Shalom, what should they do? And Rabbeinu Shalom said, you should bring a Pesach Sheni. But then the Torah says, "Vashaloi haya b'derech chayka." If you were not in a distant place, "Vashaloi haya tamei le'nefesh." You weren't tamei, and you didn't bring Karban Pesach. Then there's a fee of karis. So this, why does the Torah wait till here to tell us this? The Torah should have told us in Parshas Bai. And there's another question that they came and said, "Lomani gora." Why should we be worse? Now we know a klal in the Torah that Isaac b'mitzvah patan a mitzvah. If you're busy with one mitzvah, you're patan for doing mitzvah and mitzvah. A person can only do one thing. If you do one, you don't have to do the other. So these people were busy with a mes mitzvah. They were doing a mitzvah. They were part of bringing Garden Pesach. They had no mitzvah to bring it. So what is this lomani gora? I mean, that's the way it is. You do one mitzvah, you don't do the other mitzvah. What's your problem? What's the complaint to these people? Which gets us to one of the most fundamental things of the Torah. How do we know that something is true? How do we know that something is true? How do we know? How do we know that we have evidence? We have evidence. We could bring documents and photographs, and I mean, these are all could be falsified. You know, documents could be forged, and photographs could be photoshopped, and all kinds of things can be. That's none of these things are. Whoops! What did I just say? Okay. Is it okay?
Yes.
I don't have any leaves. So it doesn't matter. I am in a certain way, I'm a Holocaust survivor. I was born after the Holocaust, but I grew up and my father was a Holocaust survivor. My mother, I grew up in a family of Holocaust survivors. It was part of my experience. So to me, Holocaust denial is nothing. Today there's a lot of Holocaust denial. You can't deny the Holocaust to me, even though I wasn't there. But if you go tell some farm boy in Kansas that there was no Holocaust, and you tell him that there's no traces of cyclone B gas in the rocks, and there's this and that, how is he supposed to know? I mean, you tell, you know, the preponderance of evidence, but maybe, you know, you can't be sure. But to me, it's irrelevant. The whole thing is a joke. Why? Because it's part of my memory. It's part of my experience. And it's not directly part of my experience because I wasn't there. But it's part of my experience through my parents and through my parents' friends. So there is a memory which is passed down from generation to generation. How does the United States know that there was a President Lincoln? Do we know it? Of course we have artifacts, of course we found documents, of course we found shards of pottery which proved to us that there was an Abraham Lincoln. No, we know that there was an Abraham Lincoln because the United States still remembers him. When I was a little boy, the super in my apartment building was an old black man whose grandfather was a slave. There's still the memory is still alive. The United States collectively remembers him, even though there's nobody alive today. Do we remember George Washington? I don't know. Do we remember Columbus? I doubt it. So this memory can go up to a certain point. Now, in 1999, there was a war in Europe in Kosovo. A war between the Serbs and the Kosovars, the Muslims and the Orthodox Christians. And the war was, after the Yugoslavian collapsed, then the hatred of the Serbs for the Kosovars was able to express itself. Now, what was the hatred about? Because they lost the Battle of Kosovo. And they wanted payback, they wanted revenge for the defeat that they suffered in the Battle of Kosovo. This is 1999. Now, when was the Battle of Kosovo? Okay, I'm not going to ask anybody to guess, but the Battle of Kosovo was in 1369. So 630 years, that sinna and that nekama was still burning in their hearts. They sucked it in with their mother's milk, and it was there, and it was burning. And as soon as they got the chance, when Tito died, then communism collapsed, and the Yugoslavian Confederate fell apart, right away, kill them, this and that, and drive them out of their homes, and it was big war. And 630 years it was kept under wraps by the Ottoman Empire, by the Byzantine Empire, it was the Ottoman Empire, and then by the Russians. But then as soon as it's off, the Arabs, when they talk about the West, what do they say? They say Jews and Crusaders. Jews and Crusaders. I mean, to us, you know, Crusades are like, you know, we don't really think a lot about the Crusades, except for what they did to us. But to the Arabs, the Crusades is still a very vivid memory. It's the hatred that they have for the Christians for invading Eretz Yisrael and taking it away from them for 80 years. It's burning in them. It's burning in them. There's never calmed down. I once spoke about this to a group in England. And they told me that the Battle of Hastings is also, they've never forgotten. I don't really appreciate that, what the Battle of Hastings, why it's so big, but apparently it's big. So, but hatred or strong emotions can drive a memory for a very long time. for a very long time. But the Torah, the genius of the Torah, is that the Torah has something else. What the Torah, there's three parts to the Torah, the mitzvahs. There's mitzvahs v'adam l'amakim, there's mitzvahs v'adam l'chaveroi, and there are mitzvahs of memory. Of God, excuse me? Okay. I was saying there are three parts to the mitzvahs of the Torah. There's the mitzvahs v'adam l'chaveroi, which is between the relationship of a person and God, b'nodem l'chaveiro, a relationship with other people, and then there's the mitzvahs of zechira, of memory. There are many mitzvahs in the Torah that govern memory. We're supposed to remember what happened in those days. Zechira tzias Mitzrayim. We have to remember tzias Mitzrayim. We have to remember the revelation. We have to remember that God spoke to Klal Yisrael. And what the Torah does is that it weaves that memory into the fabric of our lives. We live it every single day. We live it in the Yom Tovim, we live it in everything that we do, we live it in the Tefillin and everything that we do. We say Shema Yisrael every day, and Tzias Mitzrayim, Zeichel Tzias Mitzrayim, Kiseder, every Shabbos, every Yom Tov, and that is part of our lives. And if it becomes part of our lives, it's how we live. It's not just something that once in a while these people in Kosovo get together with a bottle of beer in front of the fireplace, they tell stories of hate. This is every single day, it's part of how we live. And that way, by doing this, the memory can go on forever. Forever. There's no limit to how far the memory can go on. So now I'll give you a good example of this. Take the Churban Beis HaMikdash, the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, which was 2,000 years ago. So could you tell us that there was no Churban Beis HaMikdash? No, because what do you mean? I mean, we have Shlomo B'Tavis, and we have Shabbos HaBetamos, and we have Tisha B'Av, and we break a glass by a wedding, and we have patches of unpainted in the house. There's so many things that we do that commemorate this as part of our lives, our culture, it's how we live. So you can't say it's not true. Everybody understands that. That to deny the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash is ridiculous. That was 2,000 years ago. You go back 1,000 more, and you're by Yetzias Mitzrayim, and the things that we do that commemorate Yetzias Mitzrayim are much more than the things that we do that commemorate the Churban of the Beis HaMikdash. So that way, by weaving it into what it now the greatest conduit for the transmission of this memory from generation to generation is the Korban Pesach. It's the Korban Pesach. The Korban Pesach all year there's a mitzvah of telling about Yetzias Mitzrayim. The Korban Pesach is of remembering Zechira. We have to just mention it. But the Pesach, like the Seder we have is really the replacement of the Korban Pesach. Now what happened with the Korban Pesach, they brought a Korban Pesach, and they sat there and they told the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim every single year. Now, you can imagine the scene that there was on the Korban Pesach, where all Klal Yisrael came to Yerushalayim, the pandemonium, the madness that was going on there, the people in the streets, the smells, the sights, the jugglers, the beggars, the pickpockets, what was going on over there. It was an incredible, incredible event if you try to imagine it. And then everybody's busy organizing the Chabura. You're going to sign up which one? You sign up here, you sign up there. And the Beis HaMikdash and the Kaihanim, and it was something that was so imprinted on the mind of every child, of every human, of every adult, certainly, but certainly about the children, that it was something unforgettable. And this is the Korban Pesach. This is the mitzvah of the Korban Pesach. This is the main time of the whole year. This is how we pass down the memory from generation to generation. And this guarantees that the memory will continue on and on forever until Mashiach comes. Now, these people by the Pesach Shedi that were Tabei, but they said Lama Nigora, they weren't worried that they are losing out on mitzvah. They were doing a different mitzvah. They didn't need that mitzvah. I said mitzvah, potter mitzvah. You do one mitzvah, you don't do the other mitzvah. But they said Lama Nigora, why are we worse? Why should we be worse? Why in our family should the transmission of the memory from generation to generation be weaker than it is in other families? That's what they were saying. They were saying, why should our our passing on the memory from generation to generation, why should that be weaker than in other families? We should also have an opportunity. So they were given, so the Rebbe Shalom said, you make Pesach Sheni. Now later, by B'nai Slavcha, by the daughters of Slavcha, it says that because they asked about the inheritance of the land, so therefore they merited that the laws of the inheritance should be said through them. Now the same thing is over here. The reason why a Karban Pesach is the only mitzvah that there's a punishment for, that there's karis, is because Pesach and Mila, because Mila is what a Jew is, and Pesach is what a Jew believes. Pesach is the foundation of the memory of what Jewish people believe, of our emunah in the revelation of the Rabbanu Shlalom, Yitzias Mitzrayim at Matan Torah. That is Pesach, and they understood that if you would not have Pesach, they would be worse. The Gora, our families would be lacking. It's not just a mitzvah that we do. Our families would be lacking. So because of that, they merited that this point, that there is chorus for it, that this is critical, that was said through them. It was not said in Parshas Bayi. This is the idea of what a Karban Pesach is in Kishore. So now, the Greeks, after 80 years of studying the Jewish people and the Jewish Torah, the Jewish culture, understood this. And they knew that the only way that you could defeat Klal Yisrael, the only way that you could defeat the Torah, is by undermining this aspect of the Torah. So they said, Mila, of course, you understand, Mila is a sign, but Rish Chodesh, when they said that you cannot do Rish Chodesh, that means that the Chachamim could not set the calendar, then that would disrupt all the Yom Tovim and make all the Yom Tovim lose their credibility, and eventually they believed, I don't know if they were right in this, but eventually they believed that by disrupting the calendar and by making Pesach sometimes come here and sometimes come there, and sometimes the Sukkot will come and Shavuos and everything be all over the place somewhere in the Greek calendar, that would demean the Yom Tovim and make them less effective and less powerful, and eventually the whole thing would fall apart and there would be no memory, and then all you could just say is, it's a myth, it's a legend. And that's what they went to do. That's how, by Hellenizing the people and by undermining the memory, the Messiah, the tradition of the Torah. This is what they set out to do. If I have a few, I want to make one more point. I have a theory, and you can argue with this, but it's my theory, that there are many, many different fields of study. There are the arts and the humanities, and there are the sciences. And I have a theory that the arts and humanities are inherently more attractive and more fulfilling to students because they give them the opportunity of being creative. Everybody wants to achieve immortality, and you achieve immortality by writing philosophy because if you create something, then it's yours and it's there forever. Science does not create anything. Science just discovers what there is. Two people can discover the same scientific principle. They didn't make that scientific principle. That's there in the world. But two people can discover it. It's brilliant, it's useful, it's important, but it's not something of yours. So therefore, it doesn't give you immortality. It doesn't give you that. In other words, Aristotle. Take Aristotle. Aristotle wrote a book on philosophy. It's important today. People study his book, even though it was written 2,500 years ago. But he also wrote a book on biology, which is totally worthless. Who is interested in this book on biology? And even if he had written something which was right in that book on biology, it's been superseded so many times that really it has no importance. So that's just a footnote to history, that he once wrote a book, and if you really want to write, if you have nothing to do, you need to write a doctoral thesis, and you want to go study, study his book on biology, so go do it. But it does not have any kind of life, any kind of meaning. So therefore, that doesn't give you that same type of satisfaction as writing a play. You could read Homer, you could Euripides, you could read all these things today, and it's just something people study. It's real. It's real. So that gives, the brilliant students will be more drawn to this type of study, anything which is creative, which is distinctive. historiography, philosophy, arts, literature, poetry, music, anything like that would be more satisfying to a student than something which is more scientific and technological. So when in the Greek civilization, there was the Hellenic and the Hellenistic. Hellenic was the early part, and the Hellenistic was the second one, where it was already went down. In the early part, you had Socrates and Plato and Aristotle. It was very high level, and all the great playwrights. It was very high level culture. Then it went into decline, and the new philosophers were the skeptics and the cynics and the Epicureans, which was already pretty much of a decadent type of philosophy, and everything, the whole, even the sculpture, everything went into decline. So at that time, the brilliant students are no longer drawn to these fields because they don't really give you that type of satisfaction. Mm-hmm. So they turn towards technology. So in those times, you had Archimedes, and you had Hero, and you had Galen, and you had Euclid, and you had a big upsurge in technological advancement. So technological advancement is a symptom of a culture in decline. If you have, when the culture is at its height, then the cream of the crop will go to the higher types of fields, but when it goes into decline, then the best ones will go to the... We had the good fortune at the time of Hanukkah that we came into contact with the Greeks when they were in the Hellenistic period, so they were not as attractive to us as they would have been had we come into contact with them in the earlier period when they were much, much greater. But as it was a terrible struggle, and Baruch Hashem, the Rebbeinu Shleilam made us victorious. We are now reliving the period of Hanukkah. Greek culture was buried for 1,000 years. It rose again in the Renaissance. In the 1700s and the 1800s, it was very, very high. You had Voltaire, and you had Kant, and then you had Karl Marx before he was discredited. Was social theory was really very exciting and considered, you know, the brotherhood of man, and you know, and all these ideas, and it was these great, great ideas. In the 20th century, there were no ideas. What happened in the 20th century? What kind of ideas were presented in the last 100 years? Deconstructionism? I mean, what is there? What is this? Nothing. There's nothing going on. So if there's nothing going on, we get a lot of technology. We get cell phones. We get space shuttles. We get all these different computers. We get derivatives. We get people. Because all the bright minds, instead of going towards something which is of lasting value, will turn to something else. At least it'll make money from them or it'll do something. So we are now really living in the period which really mirrors the period of Hanukkah. And right now, we also see the same type of assault on the Jewish people, on the Torah. We see the draw to Hellenization. Assimilation is very, very strong. I don't know what the percentages were then. Percentages today are very, very high. We don't have the attacks on the Torah, like, you know, forbidding Mila, forbidding Shabbos and Rosh Chodesh, but we have different attacks. Today they become more sophisticated. Today they attack the Torah with blind macro-Darwinism. Today they attack the Torah with biblical criticism. Today they attack the Torah with the minimalist archaeology. And these are just as dangerous as the attacks that we had at that time. And just like we needed a Yeshua in those days, we need a Yeshua in these days. And this is what I have come to tell you. This is what we're living through. We are actually today living through Neo-Hanukkah. This is the Neo-Hanukkah. And just as the Rebbeinu Shlom helped us then, the Rebbeinu Shlom should help us now. He should bring us the Yeshua, and we should all be Zeicha as soon as possible. We should see B'Shiach Tzakeinu. May we move on, amen.
Okay, thank you very much, Rabbi Ryman. Thank you, Rabbi Ryman. We'll still be here for a little bit for those who'd like to ask questions. I only gave him directions on the way here, so he doesn't know.
I need to get a GPS.
So for those that would like to, I saw in the crowd there were a few names that were not so familiar to everyone, but brilliant ideas nonetheless, and anyone would like to follow up with Rabbi Ryman and some... He will be a Tamarav.